Hello there, welcome to the Tech Means Business podcast. This is a series of podcasts that looks at the way technology underpins today's business and influences society in general. It's that socio-political element that concerns us today. Privacy online is a hot topic, not just concerns over what happens to personal information, but also potential unwanted governmental oversight, for instance, and of course, cybersecurity too. Today's guest is Seven. That's Dr. Stephen Waterhouse to you and I, a British tech entrepreneur who's behind the Orchid VPN platform. It's a VPN, that's Virtual Private Network, acronym fans, that's designed to allow complete anonymization of internet traffic that's paid for by an arguably anonymous system of cryptocurrency payments. So there's a lot to get into here, but before we begin, Seven, welcome to the show, and please, as has become tradition, give us a quick rundown about yourself and how you got to create Orchid.
Of course, happy to do that. So I was born in England, the northeast, actually in Newcastle. Grew up in a little seaside town called Tynemouth until I was eight. Then moved with my parents to the southeast, just north of London in Hertfordshire, and was a very avid rugby player back in the day. Yeah, I actually did England trials when I was 16 and kind of competed at a pretty high level when I was young, mostly because I was very tall. And then as everybody else caught up with me, I realized that you actually had some skill in the game also, and you couldn't just run through people. But still, I was very excited to carry on playing rugby and was pretty nerdy too. So I ended up having a kind of pick of universities. So I decided to go to Cambridge because, you know, they played rugby and it seemed like a fun place to study, and started the engineering degree there. Subsequently got concussed a couple of times in the first couple of weeks of playing rugby there and decided to quit. So that led to a different sporting career where I ended up on the Cambridge rowing team. There's a point to this story, by the way. So I started rowing and ended up on the university team and was having a great time, kind of traveling the world, and somewhat forgot about my studies until my third year. And I was like, I better really pull the stops out here. Managed to do pretty well in the degree, and then hadn't quite made the top rowing team. So I decided that in order to stick around, I would go do a master's degree at Cambridge. That was the primary reason, was to go rowing. So I managed to qualify for this master's degree in speech recognition, which was a like very niche kind of thing at the time. So then I was happy. I was doing my master's degree and trying to get in the team. Got kind of exhausted and sick from too much training. So I decided to stop rowing during the middle of my master's degree, and actually found it quite interesting. So suddenly I'm playing around with state-of-the-art speech recognition technology and really cool advanced computer systems we had at Cambridge. And then I was like, well, you know, I'll just stick around for a PhD, and you never know, I might get in the crew one of these days. My rowing career just stopped at that point, and I got fascinated by the research I was doing. Then completed my PhD over the next 3 or 4 years. And midway through that, ended up spending a summer in Palo Alto in 1995. Which is sort of my real first time in the United States at that time, and fell in love with the lifestyle out here. First of all, the novelty of being paid to write code was just fascinating to me. The fact that there would be companies and startups that you could do this for, it was kind of like out of the movies that I'd seen about startups in Silicon Valley. So decided to move out here in 1997, started a company with a friend of mine, and we were initially consulting for NASA, doing like hardcore data analysis using deep learning and stuff that no one really understood what we were talking about. And over the next few years, I tried to convince people that this is the future of data analysis, and you know, you're going to need to use these things to, we were adapting it to web personalization and all these kind of things. We were very far ahead of our time. Anyway, that company, fascinating small team, but we sold it off for a small amount to, I think, Panasonic Ventures or something funded company.
So this was during the dot-com boom, and no one really, I guess, at that time was talking about data science?
Yeah, so then it was the dot-com boom, and I ended up really wanting to go into some very, very hardcore kind of technology. But before that, ended up in an advertising-supported dot-com company that grew to like 1,500 people in a year and funded by SoftBank, and just like the craziest of the crazy kind of thing you could do. So I got to see that insanity like firsthand. Then this is the beginning of my journey into decentralized systems. So I it was around the time of Napster and Nutella and the file sharing technologies that were happening then. And I was really fascinated by this technology. I thought it was had the potential to really change the way that the internet worked and kind of make it go back to kind of like the original designs of the internet. And the company I joined was a little company called InfraSearch. And it was started by some of the early guys who worked on Nutella. Nutella was the sort of first really distributed file sharing system. It's ancient history for a lot of people here, I'm sure. Anyway, so as the dot-com sort of venture funding and the sort of collapse of that whole industry started, and we were running around trying to get funding and ran into Sun Microsystems, who made us an offer to join the team and get acquired. So then I ended up running the peer-to-peer research team at Sun underneath Bill Joy and Mike Clary, who are the guys who pioneered the work on Java and Genie, and then Jaxter, which was the system we worked on. I ended up then having another idea, which is what if you could use peer-to-peer networking for distributed storage and archival storage? And that turned out to be a good idea. So we basically started a little company inside Sun and took that to market over 3 years. And it was a fascinating kind of learning very hardcore distributed systems and commercializing it. So that was end of one chapter. At the time, we were working with guys like Kodak Ophoto, which was some of the first people to really sort of digitize and store your photos online. The inspiration there was this observation that storage was changing from being just high-speed storage, in other words, database transactions, which you need a very different kind of disk architecture and file system architecture, to storage where you would just store things and never think about it, you know, leave them forever, like infinite storage. And that was a very radical idea at the time. We would just store things forever, and we ran models at the time saying, in the end, this storage will really cost very little, and the cost will end up being very much focused on the data center costs, which is kind of interesting right now when you think about mining, where the majority of the cost ends up being electricity, and we don't think too much about how much did this chip actually cost to buy. So we did a lot of interesting analysis there. I then spent another chunk of my career working on intellectual property, primarily fighting patent trolls, which are a very interesting artifact of the patent legal system. Patent trolls are companies which acquire patents and then assert them against other companies and essentially kind of extort money. So it's like your legal bill will probably end up more than the company's offering to settle with you for. There's been a lot of this stuff. There's another side to this, though, however, which is that there are many startups that fail in terms of commercial ability or commercial success, but end up with a lot of intellectual property. And I talked to a bunch of friends, and one of my friends from the early.com days was an old school kind of cypherpunk character. And he said, "Have you looked at Bitcoin?" And I said, "Well, I've kind of read about it here and there. And I'm trying all this whole, you know, digital currency. We've tried this before with DigiCash. Like, what's the big deal?" And he goes, "No, you should really check it out. It's really interesting." So off I went and I dug in and played around with it, tried to buy some from Mt. Gox, and just like really, really early. There's no tools out there. It was very, very basic. But I was fascinated. I thought this has the real potential to change the world. Having spent a little bit of time inside finance at Fortress and previously my other companies, I saw how inefficient everything was, just how complex the systems that they had to manage money, move money, you know, do loans. Just everything was just almost like manual paperwork. We had people moving faxes back and forth inside Fortress between them and other places, doing wires. I watched people do wires where the piece of paper sat on the desk for a couple of days and they were like, "Oh yeah, I forgot about that. I should make sure that gets out." I was like, this has just got to change. So we started a small group looking at Bitcoin primarily, and we included other kinds of currencies because we weren't sure what was going to happen next. And it was myself, Pete Brigger, Mike Novogratz, and then subsequently we brought in Dan Moorhead. And through that summer, we managed to put together quite a lot of Bitcoin just from people being excited to invest in something because it was hard to buy Bitcoin. It wasn't like you went to an exchange. It was go to Mt. Gox, or I think Bitstamp had just started. So it was just a very, very nascent thing. And the idea of putting money into a fund, which was at the time the Fortress Digital Currency Fund became Pantera, was a really interesting idea. At the same time, we started investing in startups, and we managed to invest in Zappo, Bitstamp, Circle. I'm trying to think of some of the other companies from that early round, but just some really interesting early infrastructure plays in that first fund. Then the Silk Road happened, and quite rightly, the guys at Fortress were very concerned that there was some reputational risk here. So with their backing and the backing of Benchmark and also River Capital, we spun out Pantera and started essentially a new company. It was actually an iteration of another fund that Dan had run before in terms of branding and naming, and he had a tremendous experience in running funds there. But suddenly we were off to the races and launching basically the first institutional venture fund and hedge fund focused on crypto with, you know, backing from these blue chip Wall Street guys. So it was an incredibly exciting time. You know, a couple of months later, Mt. Gox got hacked. So that was crazy. I'm sitting on the board of Bitstamp, which is suddenly became the world's largest exchange. And we then put together the second venture fund and then got to invest really in the beginning of, you know, kind of blockchain ideas, what became the smart contract space and eventually the token space. Yeah, we really got to meet all of the sort of kind of OGs of the space. And the idea that at the time, and this was pre-election 2016, I would sit at dinner parties and have a conversation and they'd say, oh, like, you know, give me a dystopian theory. And I was like, well, here's my dystopian theory. What if we elect somebody and then something happens in the world, some catastrophe, and the next thing you know, we have martial law, which seems like a good idea at the time, or there's some crisis, and the next thing you know, the surveillance increases, and then increases a little bit more, and then the next thing you know, we have Patriot Act number two. And then once you get to the point where all your communications are surveilled and there's no way to communicate in a decentralized way or access information in a decentralized way or in a way that's not subject to surveillance, you actually have no ability to change the government. So it's like, it's a kind of very dystopian idea. It's like, what if we just end up with authoritarian governments? Or what if we want authoritarian governments? And again, this is pre-2016. This is obviously pre-COVID. And unfortunately, I start to see, especially today, a lot of the signs that we are ending up moving into that world. So that was very much the inspiration for what we then started next with my co-founders is Orchid. And we've been working on this for the last 3.5 years. It was funny. I was chatting to somebody at some partner company yesterday, and he's like, wow, you've been working on this since 2017. You're really OG. And I was like, I've been working in crypto since 2013. He goes, oh my God. Like, the space has a very short memory and also like a very fast time pace, of course. You know, it just seems like the other day that, you know, we didn't know anything about DeFi, and suddenly now DeFi's everywhere. It's a good thing and a bad thing in the sense that having short memories does enable you to think things through for the almost like from first principles for the very first time and come up with crazy ideas that with the benefit of history, you might not do. You might just say, that's a crazy idea. Someone tried that already. Why would you do that? But these fresh eyes do have a lot of advantages. The disadvantages is that things can already go wrong when you don't remember history. So I try to keep my knowledge of what's happened with the same experience, but at the same time, almost have like a naive, childlike view of what's possible.
It sounds to me, Seven, you're a bit of an optimist, yet with a political streak, one that, I don't know, could be termed cynical, maybe? Are you a believer in a dystopian concept of data protection and anonymity?
Yeah, so it's like, I mean, just take a look at my personal situation right now. I'm sitting in San Francisco, looking out at what appears to be an incredibly foggy day in the middle of summer, the worst fog you'd ever imagine in the middle of summer. We never see anything quite this thick. You can't see more than, you know, a few hundred feet. And a couple of days ago, the skies were orange because we had like high altitude particle smoke. Now that smoke is down at ground level and the AQI is over 250, which is essentially, if you go for a short walk, you're going to get quite sick, potentially, breathing issues. If I want to fly to another country, I have to get a COVID test, and then they give me a tracking app on my phone when I land. So we're already there. We're already at this point where climate change is leading to situations where places that were otherwise beautiful places to live. I've lived in San Francisco 20 years, and incredible hubs of innovation, and then suddenly climate change is starting to like really shift that very rapidly as to where people want to be and how they want to live. And I have a whole bunch of theories as to why location doesn't even matter anymore and Silicon Valley is becoming rapidly an anachronism. But the problem with what we've seen with COVID and the responses to it is that you either have this incredibly chaotic response as you've seen in the United States, which has just led to almost like a sense that in the current election, for example, I don't think that the US response to COVID even matters. I don't think that anyone really cares. They're just used to it. They're used to wearing masks and so on. They become, you know, kind of the concept of boiling the frog. We've been well and truly boiled to the point where we don't even know that we're sitting in boiling water anymore. And yet, if you want to go somewhere else or go to a place that's had a great response to COVID, for example, in parts of Asia, you're going to give up your rights to privacy for the common good, of course. But the question then becomes, well, when do you reverse that? that issue. When do we come out of the crisis? And in hindsight, you don't ever really come out of crisis. The US has been at war with the Middle East for, I mean, basically since 9/11 and potentially before. And we're always in that crisis point now. The threats of domestic terrorism, it's 9/11 today, the threats of domestic terrorism are always present. And the surveillance apparatus of the government says, we need to keep monitoring you this closely because who knows what's going to happen next. And yeah, that's true. But at the same time, what are the limits to that?
So ORCID then contains many of the elements, I suppose, we've talked about so far, surveillance, anonymity, encryption, cryptocurrencies. Which element is it that's getting most attention?
Well, the focus that we've launched initially with is what we call a decentralized marketplace for bandwidth. So that's a bit of a mouthful. But what it really means is that we believe there's a future where, just as we've seen in decentralized finance, by providing tools that allow people to build decentralized services, we think that this will enable a new kind of, you know, new kind of internet, new kinds of applications that can be run without the control of central authorities and without the surveillance that goes with those things. You know, the rest of the team also has a lot of experience in this kind of area. Our first application is we have a client, and that client is connecting to one of multiple nodes, and the nodes are currently run by professional VPN providers, guys like Private Internet Access and Liquid and Bolle, people who we've vetted to have high practices in the VPN space. Because the VPN space is a very fragmented space. There's not sort of like a Google of VPNs. And there are affiliate sites that go around recommending which VPN you should use based on their privacy practices and so on. But no one really knows whether or not these VPNs are actually logging your data and making what you thought you were paying for privacy, but maybe you're not. So our idea with the application is we're giving you the VPN that you expected. It's a VPN that allows you to connect to one or multiple VPN node providers. And by connecting to multiple VPN providers in what we call multi-hop, essentially your traffic is like hopping between different nodes, we're able to add in extra privacy layers. And this is similar to other like overlay networks or onion routing networks in the wild today and open systems. And so that's one thing we've been really focused on. We've also provided introspection into your traffic. So we have an analyzer in the application which shows you what traffic's actually coming out of your phone or out of your computer. And we have ideas to extend that to add in things like malware blocking and potentially ad blocking in the future. So the whole focus of application has been around building something which consumers can use to understand and improve their privacy, but also can be extended by other companies. The whole system is open source. Every single thing we do is open source. So we've been working with people to potentially add that into their applications.
Ah, but isn't there an issue there? And listeners, I'll have to imagine I have my most exotic tinfoil hat on, that there's a conflict between anonymity in its purest sense and a company, of course, which is ORCID, hops, if you like, that ORCID traffic takes.
No, that's a great point. And with any company that's building a decentralized architecture and network, there are portions of that along the way that might look more centralized initially. And that's true for anything. And then we look at, we're using Ethereum as a layer one, for example. And yes, there are some centralization components there with miners and so on. But by design and by architecture, it is a decentralized system, and whereas other layer ones are much less. With our layer two and the systems we built there, the initial rollout we've done is we are the curator of the nodes in the client. Now, instead of it just being that's fixed forever and ORCID Labs will be the only curator, what we've done, and this is existing already, is that the curator is actually a DAO structure and a decentralized autonomous organization. Essentially, it's like, to explain people who don't know what this means, is that we've put essentially put government into code and encapsulated that. So you, for example, Joe Green could run a curator, which has a list of different nodes. And so you're like, hey, those ORCID guys, they've done a good job. But I know some really good guys who are running VPNs, and they're like my mates, and I trust them. So if people trust you to trust them, they could choose you as the curator. And then if you find that one of your friends actually, it turns out that they're not as good as you thought they were, you can remove them from the curator, or the nodes in the curator could vote, or holders can vote. So we've architected this thing so that today it's possible, and we'll be kind of describing more about how to do this to decentralize the curation components so that you don't have to trust us. You can trust other people if you prefer. But this is actually a general problem in decentralized services that we didn't identify this, but we've been observing this. It doesn't get solved by blockchain. Like, a lot of people think that all problems in decentralized systems get solved by blockchain. In decentralized services, there are problems, for example, where not even whether the VPN is logging, which is doing code injection, for example, which is an even bigger problem there. What if the VPN is actually taking your traffic and charging you a lot for it, but just kind of throwing it away or not providing services for you? How do you trust a node that you don't know anything about? What happens when you pay them and they don't provide the service? And so on. So there's like a lot of these very interesting nuances that are really encapsulated in the way that we've done our network design. Yeah, there's a lot of thinking process that has to go into that kind of thing.
So there's so much in the ORCID VPN in terms of its elements. Could it be, do you think, Seven, that only parts of it, I don't know, say the micropayments part, only parts of it survive the long term? Or do you see ORCID continuing as a kind of meta package, as it were?
We are right now laser focused on the VPN network and putting that in the hands of people and really improving that. We've made a lot of improvements on VPN network traffic speed recently, like significant improvements, and also in making the experience of using ORCID, whether you want to use crypto or otherwise. For example, a few months ago, we launched on the iOS and OS X, the Apple stores, and we released in-app payments. So instead of having to use load OXT and create smart contracts and use dApp browsers, which is all possible, but it's quite cumbersome for the average user. And the reason it's cumbersome is that we've designed our system to still be fully decentralized. There's ways of centralizing things to make the experience easier, but we passed on that idea because it changed security designs. So instead, what we've built is that's still the main entry point, but we also have in-app payments. So now what happens is from your phone or from your computer, you can use Apple payment mechanisms and essentially your credit card that's linked through Apple to buy credits on our system. And the backend network runs exactly the same. It's all using crypto. So then the next question is, well, what about Apple monitoring you and so on? Well, yeah, Apple knows that you downloaded ORCID and then knows you made a payment to ORCID. But because we're not linked to them in the sense of the network traffic, what's happening, they don't have any idea what you're doing at that point.
So, Seven, without being so damned un-English as to ask about money specifically, is the ORCID project for you a labor of love, or what is it that's the driving force if it's not the cold, hard cash?
So we mentioned the community many times. What I really want to see is that this framework, this concept is adopted not just within the community that we're building, but within the sort of community, the emerging community of decentralized systems at large. We've actually already seen this, and there's some companies out there that have adopted our nanopayments framework for their own networks, which we're not receiving any benefit from. But I think I was just very inspired in the past by companies like Zcash and the team in Israel, Starkware, that really adding a lot of hardcore math and science to the networks and systems, and people adopting those in different ways. And then it becomes, you know, like the rising tide floats all boats, and you also receive benefit from that. So that's one thing I'd like to see as our kind of legacy within the crypto space. Within a general consumer privacy kind of mission, there's a sort of a phrase that a few years ago when we were starting this, some people were saying, hey, is this privacy thing really that big a deal? And does anyone really care? And I said, well, at least if we do this and we're relatively successful, we'll have given people a choice. We'll have given people a touch point and a proof point that you can do this. And if we can do it, then maybe you can do it. Maybe I'd like to see in the future that the VPN space is much more transparent, that its privacy and security are built in by default into architectures and system and not as an add-on. And a great example of that is just web browsers. We built web browsers, and the next thing we're like, oh, we better make them secure. So we designed SSL and TLS. That kind of making security and privacy a second consideration rather than a primary consideration, I think is a mistake. Yeah, that's really like some of the thoughts I have around where we'd like to go next.
Well, I'm afraid, as the music coming up there in the background tells you, we've run out of time for today. The ORCID VPN is available on Google Play and the Apple App Store as well. Plus, you can read about exactly how the ORCID VPN works in some detail on the company's website. Have a look down in the show notes for those links. But until next time, many thanks to Seven Dr. Stephen Waterhouse for joining me today.
Thank you, Joe.
And I hope you can all join me next time on the Tech Means Business podcast. Bye for now.